I'm Mads Torgersen, which is what it says up there. I'm a program manager at Microsoft in Redmond, and I'm the guy who runs the legendary C# language design meetings, which you can now read all about on GitHub if you want to follow along as we make all our missteps and correct ourselves over and over again in public. I'm going to talk a little bit about, actually, I'm going to talk for a full 50 minutes about C# in great detail, about what we did in the recent release and about what we're thinking about for the next release, hence the title, C# Today and Tomorrow. In the speaker room out there, Dunsheim was kind of joking, what about on Friday? So I said, Friday is F# day. Okay. So I want to take the temperature of the room here. How many people are developers or programmers? Okay, good, good. How many are in C# on a regular basis? Okay, how many are not? A few, okay. So try to hang in there. I'm gonna try to go pretty fast then, given the setup of the room. The way we think about evolving the language itself, this is sort of like a little cheat sheet to language evolution here. You can either, when you have a language and it's kind of popular, you can either evolve it a little, like slowly, or you can evolve it a lot, like more rapidly. And both are essentially going to lead to our demise, right? Both lead to certain death. If you evolve too little, you will essentially become you'll be stagnant, you'll become obsolete over time. You will not have solutions to the problems of the day, okay? Other languages are going to be smarter, people are going to pick those up. If you evolve too much, or if you evolve quickly, eventually the language will be bloated and it'll be hard to learn and it will contain the sum of many past mistakes that are no longer relevant, and so it is going to explode. So no matter what we do, it's going to be bad at the end. But so we're trying to balance this. And with C#, we try to put ourselves pretty far on the side of being of evolving pretty fast. Okay, we want the language, essentially, the motto is stay relevant with the language. C# should solve today's problems well. It should be a viable option for people to pick up, not just for people who've been programming in it for 10 years. And we want to keep it like that for as long as we can. When we can't, then we'll see. Okay, but we think we still have a lot of good years in us. So if you look at the evolution of C# so far, it's actually, we're now talking about version C# 7, codename 7. And we just released C# 6. So we've gone through quite a number of versions already, each sort of with a loose theme around it. So from just being a programming language to having generics, to having link and querying, to having dynamic and async was the big thing of C# 5. And now recently we released C# 6, which we're going to spend a little time in. That's essentially sort of a catch-up release for doing little things that makes your code nicer and helps you not write so much boilerplate. So how many people here have taken a look at C# 6 yet, sort of in anger? Quite a number, but significantly less than half. So that's going to be good. We're going to spend some time with that then. And then C# 7, we're just getting started. We have a bunch of nice feature ideas. We discuss them in public so that we can get as much feedback as possible and understand what's the most relevant thing to do and what's the best way to do it. And I'll share some of those ideas with you with the understanding that this may not be at all how it ends up, but I just want to share the thinking and see what you think about it maybe. So if there's a lot of boos and, you know, throwing of vegetables, then we'll learn something from that. Okay? All good? So a little background. .NET as a whole is evolving in new ways that I think are really interesting. One is that we are getting serious about being cross-platform. We are building .NET Core as a version of .NET, if you will, that runs not just on Windows but on Mac and Linux, and is a really good stack for especially server payloads. We're also doing VS Code, which is at the tooling level, targeting building a tool that doesn't just run on Windows, even though, you know, people can run Parallels on their Macs. So there's also Xamarin, which is not us, but which is a partner we have that is targeting iOS and Android. So C# and .NET are getting to more and more places where they can run. Right? They're getting up against more and more other choices, if you will, which we have to take into account. There's also OmniSharp, which is also a great community project helping even more different development environments target C# through kind of a shared service. So cross-platform, really important, putting C# in many, many more places than before. I think that's going to be exciting. We've also gone completely open source. We've had the whole .NET core, the runtime, the framework is fully open source. We're taking lots of contributions. What we call Roslyn is open source. The compiler components, if you will, the IDE stack of C# and Visual Basic and F# as well is open source and has actually been longer than us. So that's changing the way we work in very significant ways and helping shift things so that it becomes more of a shared community project, increasingly so, and not just what has Microsoft cooked up in secret these last 2 years and are throwing over the wall. If you're really, really interested in open source, you're in the wrong room. Martin Woodward from Microsoft is giving a talk about that right now that I recommend seeing the recording of. We're also doing native compilations on more and more platforms. You're seeing it already with Windows Universal Platform. We're actually not running C# on a JIT runtime, but we're compiling it all the way down to the specific hardware architecture, which gives some good performance benefits, especially on client architectures. But we're thinking about doing it in more and more places. We have the technology now. We just need to align it with more and more scenarios. So that's going to be promising as well. So these things are really spanning a lot of aspects of the future of C#. I do want to mention, especially since there's a talk right after mine, that F# is a really important component of what we do. F#, how many people have looked at F#? Yeah, quite a few. Okay, good. In terms of open source, F# has really blazed the trail for us. F# is genuinely a community project right now with many, many contributions coming from all sites. Microsoft obviously is a heavy contributor. There's both Microsoft Research contributing in, where the language originated, and my product group has a few people who contribute, but there's plenty of contributions even into the very core components of F# that come from the outside. So it's really been taken over by the community in that sense, and that's very inspiring to the rest of us. It's also very inspiring to us because F# is, at its core, a functional programming language, even though it smoothly adapts to the sort of object-oriented flavor of the .NET framework. And so, in a sense, it has, I think the time of functional programming features has come to an extent, and we'll see that when we talk about C# 7 in particular. And so it's a really good place to go and learn about those things. It's good inspiration for us, getting experience from that, and I think it's good for programmers. So I actually recommend, even if you're bound to C#, if you can, try doing a project in F#. Even if you don't necessarily want to switch to F# or you can't for various reasons, it has a different flavor that will enrich the way that you program C#. So a lot of people who go and do a project in a functional language like F#, they really come back to C# and they have new tricks in their bag that are really useful even while you're in C#. Okay? Dunsheim, Don and Isaac have a talk together in room 17 at 2:20, so that's where I'll be going. I'd love for all of you to come with me and we can sort of go there together. I also want to mention the Roslyn project, which is also a big underpinning effort of the .NET story and C# story in particular. The Roslyn project, we've been doing it forever. We had it sort of came out of various things like frustration with our old clunky C++ code base for how we implemented the language in the compiler and in the IDE. We wanted to implement C# in C# and VB in VB. But it also opened up a whole bunch of opportunities where we opened up essentially the whole compiler, the compiler's understanding of the language. We opened that up as an API, and made it incremental and real time so that it's equally suited for the act of batch compiling down to some executable format and to the tooling experience of interactively typing and getting feedback in real time. So essentially, sort of rationalizing a little after the fact, you can say the philosophy of Roslyn is that there should need to be no other code base in the world that understands C#. It should really serve everyone who wants to do something tooling-wise, compiling-wise, analysis-wise with C# or with VB in every way, and that's the goal. And hence, it's open source, so if people want to do something with it that we don't support, they can help hack it in and so on. So really, really core. And we have a talk about that as well, and you should go see that. That's Dustin's talk in room 11 at 3:25. So that's a language track for you. With no further ado, I am going to switch to my demo machine. I'm going to show you some of the features of C# 6 that are currently available in RTM. And you can always, even if your company doesn't support it, you can always go and download the community edition on a separate machine or whatever and play with these features and go beg if you need to do it in production. I think you should. So I mentioned briefly that the sort of overall philosophy here, we don't have this big theme like we used to. We're not solving async or querying or something like that. We just want your code to get a little nicer. So I'm going to write some code here a little nicer. I'm going to actually zoom to 100% here, so we are... I think that's going to be fine for everyone. Otherwise, come to the front. I have an extra chair here I'll give to you if you want to come closer. Okay, so... So it's sort of little fixes all around, okay? So I'm just going to take you on a quick tour through that, and it's going to be code, and it's going to be great, okay? So the first thing is that it's really common that you have a bunch of functions that you want to call all the time from a given place. Whenever you write a collection of functions, you put it in a static class somewhere, and you have to dot through that static class, like with console or write line here every time. And that's just a pain. So we made it so that we made a new kind of using clause, using static, which lets you put the static members of a static class, like system.console, or any class, any type actually, put the static members of any type directly into scope. So what you see now, if you squint, is that the console here is now grayed out. It's no longer necessary, and I can go and say, simplify this member to just be write line, and you can do that with sort of any package of functions you have. You can call it directly, and yeah, you can do that in other languages, but now you can do it in C# as well. So hopefully that's useful. You do it with things like system.math, for instance. We have an instance of that further down in the code here. You have to be a little careful. You can also import the members of an enum, for instance, because they're static members, so you can get those directly in scope. You can imagine that a lot of those weren't written with the purpose of being put directly into scope, right? They were written for the explicit purpose of being dotted to, so they might not have very unique names. And if you're not careful, you can put things into scope that will clash with each other and so on. So that's kind of the catch with this one, I would say. But very, very useful. And actually, we should just go and take these. If you haven't tried VS 2015, it has an awesome IDE experience. It's much more helpful than you've ever seen. One of the things, it just has really good, like, if you want to, it has a bunch more refactorings, helpful tips with a light bulb, and you see previews here of before and after and so on. Roslyn underlies all that deep language understanding, and you'll see more of that in Dustin's talk, I hope. Right, Dustin? Yes. Says Dustin. He's back there seeing what I already tell you. So let's apply this refactoring to everything that has console in front of it. Okay, so this is a little program that will take some points from a point class. It will print them out. It will turn them into JSON, print that out, turn them back into points again, and print those out. Okay, pretty silly. The main point of it is to show some tricks in the point class itself and the definition of it. So let's collapse the program here and look at the point class. I'm not even going to run it, but yes, it works. So one of the things is that we're seeing is one of those functional tricks that you're going to get familiar with if you use F sharp, or if you maybe if you hang around for future versions of C sharp, is more and more data is modeled in an immutable fashion. Okay, it's really really useful to have your data be immutable because so it's more like information and less like stateful representation of the world. It's good for many things. For instance, it's good for if you have a lot of concurrency, or it gives good opportunities for parallelization because you don't risk people having shared mutable state problems. You don't have to coordinate with locks and everything. There are many, many good reasons why immutability is great. And you're seeing it being used more and more, especially in a connected world. So we want to. So we're looking at places in the language where we really give short shrift to people who want to write in an immutable style. For instance, auto properties, automatically implemented properties, right? If you so take X here, if I was writing a mutable type, I could put an auto property, and I wouldn't need the backing fields and all that. But since it's immutable until now, since it only has a getter, I haven't been able to do that. But so one of the little tricks here is we now allow you to have getter-only auto properties. Okay? Anybody could find use for that? Yes, there's some nodding. Good? Yeah. Great. So glad we did that. One of the things with a getter-only auto property is how do you get a value in there in the first place if it doesn't have a setter? so we had to mull that one over a little bit. But what we say is essentially like with read-only fields, you can still assign to these guys in the constructor, right? So I can still say capital X or this.x equals, as long as I'm in the constructor, and that'll assign into it. There's actually a read-only backing field underneath generated. So I can go and delete my explicit backing fields here. And so it's straightforward to use, okay? And now it only has a getter. So that whoever did the private set trick before, you don't have to do that anymore. We also added initializers to auto properties. If you want to initialize it directly, you can do it like you do with a field. Just stick a value in there. I'm not going to make all points 5, so let's not do that. Okay? Yeah, good. On with other things that are going to help. There's a lot that's sort of around the declarative structure, making it simpler, taking away some of the fluff around declaring things. So here's a really common thing. You have a simple little method. All it does is compute something and return it. And there's a single statement in there, which is a return statement and an expression. And that's all. Okay. So there's a lot of fluff around that. If you had lambdas, you're used to being able to have an expression lambda where the body of the lambda does not have curlies and does not have a return statement, just has the expression. So we were like, why can't you just do that for methods as well? And we decided, well, maybe you should. So the way we do it, the way we put the syntax in, we figured we should take those arrows from the lambda and reuse those. So if you're used to calling those lambda arrows or something, you should probably now call them function arrows, something like that. And so now you can just put in on a method, just put an arrow, put an expression, and that's the return result of the expression. Expression-bodied functions, or expression-bodied members. We also want to do it for properties. You can see that actually a bunch of this getter-only property here is grayed out. That's because, well, it takes a little explanation. I'm not going to go too deeply in it. If you go to Dustin's talk, you'll find out about the kind of thing that is graying out my code here. This is not a core IDE feature that's graying out my code. That's a little IDE plugin that's built on top of the Roslyn framework by Dustin, by the way, and shared out as a V6 extension. So you can buy little things that will analyze your code and tell you where something is redundant and where something you don't want people to do. Built that on top of our Roslyn API and plug it into Visual Studio. And I did that. And I plugged it in. Dustin built it. And what it does is suggest places where you should use new C# 6 features in your old code so you can help modernize your code, if you will. He says, you should be using an expression-bodied member here because properties can also be expression-bodied now. If you have a getter-only property where the getter just has a return statement inside, we'll let you simplify it all the way to just this, right? So name, arrow, and the expression. And that's a computed property for you right there. So again, it gets simpler here. You can do it with other function members as well. There's operators here. We can go and simplify those. And let's use the fix all in the project here and apply that. And the operators get nice and slick, right? So code gets simpler this way. That's expression body members for you. Okay? The next thing I want to show you is string formatting. So more and more programming languages are getting built-in features for this, for formatting strings. And so they call them interpolated strings for some odd reason that I forget. But that's okay, that's a name for them, so we're going to call them that too. So the usual way you do it is very cool, though, in C#. String.format really does a lot of cool things for you. So we kind of want to retain, we want to build in string formatting in the language, but retain the expressiveness of string.format. So the way we do that is to take, the problem with string.format is you have these placeholders with numbers in them, right? And then you have a bunch of arguments at the end, and you have to keep track of, with no compiler help or anything, matching them up correctly. It's really easy to get wrong, and maybe nobody will notice because the program still runs until it's in production and it has swapped the last and first names of people or whatever. So we want to solve that in the same go. So what we do is we say, let's keep that string here and throw the rest away. And then we put a dollar sign in front of the string. So a dollar sign means this is an interpolated string literal. And if you notice what happens, so let's remove the dollar sign. You see now it's just a string literal. Then I put the dollar sign and you see, if you can see it, the parts of the string now become black. That's because the curlies in the string now with the dollar in front, with this being an interpolated string, the curlies are now significant. They mean here's a hole in the string and you can put any expression in that hole and that expression will get evaluated and two-stringed and the result of that will get glued in this place. So what this interpolated string does right now is it actually writes a zero if you print this out, because it's expression zero sitting in here, not a placeholder anymore. What I really want to write is X and Y, so I just put them in there in the holes, and there you go. You have your thing formatted just as before. But if you want to use some of those cool things with the string.format, you can still do that. You can still have your alignment or your format specifiers or whatever. That actually still works. You can still put that directly in those holes. But getting the expressions right in where they're going to get formatted, that helps you not mess up the code, and obviously it's much more short and readable. So I hope, is this going to be useful? Yeah? Thank you. There's someone it's going to be really useful for over there. The thing you heard there is something called applause. They do that a lot in America. But I'm not angling for it in any way. It's not that. Okay, so we can also do it with the verbatim strings. You can interpolate a verbatim string. Here I've used a concatenation to build a JSON literal here. If I interpolate it, I can make it much nicer. Then I don't have to stop the string here and concat things and it all looks messy. I can just keep going. Right, I put a hole in there. There's something wrong here. It's confused about the curly up here. If you want actually have a curly in your code, which you do in a JSON literal, you put double curly just like you do with string.format. And so now it can figure out that that the double curly is a curly, the single curly is a hole in my verbatim string here, and I put a double curly down here again, and again, it's much, much more readable than before, okay? Let's see. I'm going to skip this one because that's just too crazy. So that's interpolated strings. Here is the method that takes some JSON and turns it into a point. Okay. So what it is? So this is the line that actually turns it into a point. And all the previous stuff is the logic to check if it's in the right shape, if the JSON is in the right shape to be turned into a point, and throw an exception if it's not. So we could do several things with this. First of all, that's a whole lot of if conditions here, right? Most of them are about, is something accidentally null in here? Like null, this a lot. Like you protect yourself against null, and it's very verbose, and it clutters what's the actual logic. So let's make that easier. Instead of explicitly checking if the Y of the JSON is null here, I can use a new conditional operator. I can say, essentially, we call this the null conditional operator question here, also sometimes known as Elvis for some reason. There's two eyes and there's some hair that's swirly, so I think that's why. What this does is to say, if the left-hand side to the left of the question dot operator is null, then that whole operation is null. So it just propagates the null. instead of giving you an exception. But if it's not null, then we dot and get the value out. So what you get out of here is either null or it's the type. Okay? And you compare that to jtokenType.integer. So that means that just already does the right thing, and we don't need to check first if it's null. We can delete that line. Okay? Similarly here, exactly the same thing. We're still checking for null up there if JSON itself is null, but we can also use a null conditional operator in front of an indexer to say, you know, make the whole thing null if JSON is null, otherwise index into it. Okay? So that's the null conditional operator for you. Now we can delete that last line, and you can kind of see now we're just down to the essence of the question. If there is a type and it's not integer, or if there is a type that's integer, or if there is a type that is, and if there is a type that is y, we can succeed. So yeah, thank you. Did you travel from far away, sir? Sorry, I shouldn't make that kind of joke. But I'm going to get fired now, but I'll have fun until then. Okay, quickly. Here is a squiggle. That's Dustin's little plugin that's telling me I'm doing something wrong here. I'm doing something suspicious. Okay. It says consider using name of for the parameter name. So that's the next feature. Whenever you're referring to something, you're writing a string that represents some string literal that represents something that is named in the program, you're likely to run into this problem of, hey, I don't like the name JSON. I'm going to call this, you know, arg or something. Well, I forget to rename that thing down there, unless I remember to include strings, but then I'm probably going to rename some that I didn't mean. So that's a problem. So what we do instead is to introduce refactoring safe string literals for this purpose. We call it the name of feature because it's called name of in the language. It's pretty straightforward there. So I can put name of JSON instead, and that still gives me the string literal JSON. But it's refactoring safe, right? And the compiler checks. If I write some gobbledygook in here, it's going to say, whoa, there's a red squiggly here because you don't have anything called JSON. So it checks that you're right, and if you refactor, if you do a rename, it knows about that thing too, right? And so that helps. And if you look at this one here, we can do the same thing. It's talking about point, but what if the class changes its name? What we really should be doing is making an interpolator string in which we say name of point. So we're putting the point name in such a way that if we change the name of the class, if we do a rename here, you can see all those point things light up, and we change point to pair or something, then it also gets changed here, and the error message stays current. Right? It's good for error messages, of course. It's also good for reflection and various places where you're really using the names of things. Okay? Little feature, but very useful. What else can we do? Let's look at going the other way. So I have an instance method here, taking my point and turning it into JSON. If only JSON had really had an X and a Y member, the J object I'm creating, then I could have used an object initializer and created it in one expression. And it's kind of annoying that I have to first create one, put it in a temporary variable, then assign, have all these temporary states of it visible and so on. It'd be nice if I could do like with an object initializer, and so you can now. So if we say new J object here and use the indexing syntax here, we put X equals capital X and Y equals capital Y. Then I've now initialized the J object right as I created it, right? So now I can delete those separate assignments. I never see the temporary states. If I move code around, I'm not going to refactor it wrong. Actually now, let's see, we could inline this temporary variable now. And actually now Dustin tells me consider using an expression-bodied member, so I can go and do this, and whoa, it really collapsed quite a lot, and it's just saying exactly what it does. Okay? Few things more to mention. I want to mention exceptions. We did a little with exceptions here. One thing we did is that sometimes if you have an exception that you just sometimes want to catch, you don't always want to catch this kind of exception. Right. The best thing you can do in C# is to catch it, look at it, and say, nah, I didn't want this one, and then rethrow it. That's really bad. Then the subsequent catch clauses in that same try-catch aren't going to catch it if they could, and you lose where it originally came from. You kind of overwrite that thing in the inside of the exception. So catch rethrow is bad. So what would be good is if you could look at it before you catch it, and that's what exception filters are for. And those of you in here who know VB or F sharp, they already have exception filters. It's just C sharp that's been a holdout. So what you can do now is you can say when, and then some condition, some Boolean condition in parentheses here. So I can say when E dot occurrences is greater than 3, for instance. And then this exception will only catch if it will. So it'll run the code inside of these parentheses here and say, is this exception, should it be caught? And if not, it's not going to change anything. It's going to keep the stack the way it is. It's going to be like the exception didn't fit, like the type didn't fit. Same effect. Okay. Good thing to be able to do. Another thing that I really almost want to apologize for is that when we did async, async is great, but the reason it's great is that it looks, your async code with awaits in it looks almost exactly like the code you would have written synchronously. That's its whole claim to fame. But there are places where that doesn't work in C# 5. And those places, the most egregious places at least, are inside catch and finally blocks. You can't await. But that's really annoying because I might want to do something when I catch that is itself async. And so we fixed that as well. The workarounds that people have had to do, has anybody run into this? Yeah, there's one. Okay, two, three, good. Yeah, four. You're making me feel better and better about having fixed it. The workarounds for this are kind of atrocious. And so we took all that atrociousness and we put it into the compiler. You don't have to be atrocious anymore. We'll be it for you. You can feel good and clean. So now you can say something like await repository.log. I want to log that I got this exception asynchronously. So I can do that now. And await in there. And then the catch block isn't going to end until after, you know, it's going to wait for that await. Finally is even better. Somebody really wanted that. Good. Similarly, when you finalize, you want to close. I want to close the file. Well, this is asynchronous. It might take time. I don't want to block my thread on it, so I want to be able to do it asynchronously. Well, I can await repository.close async here. And it's just going to work. Okay? So that's what I wanted to show about C# 6. Any questions? I'll take one, looking at the clock. No, you want to see C# 7. Yes, there's one. Yes, you get it. What was that? Why? Yeah, I can't hear the question. When you get to use null? When do we lose it? Like, when do we get rid of it? Well, we have this thing about breaking changes. There are languages that deal better with null from the start. Some languages don't even have a notion of null as such. They will have a more integrated with the type system approach where that you can have an option of something. So let's get back to that in a minute, because I'm going to start talking about C# 7 now. Is that a good enough answer for now? So we can't break the language and say there's no more null in this language, but maybe there are things that we can do that can give you the second best thing. And I'm gonna switch back to slides, and unfortunately, C# 7 is gonna be slides. I don't actually have demos for you yet. We're only just starting to prototype, no demos have been shown in public yet. But we are starting to play with these features, soon. But for now, main themes for C# 7. Okay, the overall main thing is we want to do crazy things. Like, we did a bunch of little things in C# 6. We were being modest. Roslyn was coming out. We were focusing a lot on that. The things we do in C# 7 are likely to be bigger or have more of that conceptual impact that await, for instance, had. And so there may be fewer of them, but we'll see. So some of those, you'll see. One of the things we continue focusing on is that more and more, almost all the code in the world is distributed now, right? You're writing client or server software that talks to something else, and there's data going back and forth on the wire, and how you deal with that data is something that is turning out to be more cumbersome in a language like C# than, for instance, it would be in F#. And we want to rectify that. We want to be relevant to today's problems, and we're kind of falling behind there a little, where the object-oriented paradigm is great for many things, but it doesn't fit so well with some data coming in that you kind of want to look at from the outside and do things with, depending on its shape, for instance. Let's look at that a bit. We also want to look a little at performance, at places where you're forced to do dumb things performance-wise today, like doing a lot of copying in the language. Can we help you with better alternatives? Realizing that C# doesn't run only on big, beefy machines anymore, right? We can't just expect next year's machines that run C# to be bigger than this year's, because it runs on smaller and smaller devices. We want it to run on the smallest possible devices. And by the way, also, if you run it in the cloud, those cycles do cost money. So we want to help you save on that. Unless you do it in Azure, then we want you to spend a lot. I'm sure Scott covered that this morning. So to jump right in, some of the things that we think can help with this. Tuples, essentially the idea of grouping together more than one value temporarily and kind of letting them travel together. That's the thing that we're looking at. A common scenario for that, the most common scenario by far, is I want to return more than one value. How do I do that today? Well, I have an out parameter. That sure is ugly. And by the way, it doesn't work with asynchronous methods. I can write my own little class or struct every time, and I litter my code with all these named entities that are really only just for transport for a little bit. You would get tally result or something like that here. Instead, we want you to just be able to list all the values that you want to return. Okay? So that's a tuple. We think of those as being analogous to parameter lists. Okay, so we want to make them as similar to the list of parameters that you get to a method. So that means we think that tuples should have components with types and names. And so what you get back from this method is something that has a sum that you can access by saying .sum and account. And both of those will be ints. Okay? So you want to access it something like this. So there are tuple types, names in them, there will be tuple literals, so you can create those tuples. And then either you get the tuple and dot your way into it, or there should probably also be some syntax, I don't know if it should be this, that lets you kind of decompose the tuple right away when you get it. So it comes flying in, and immediately you say, here are two variables to hold those two things in, and the tuple itself is never really a thing. Which is how you, it's similar to how you would do with parameters, passing things in. You don't group things first and then pass them. You pass them just in one swoop, as many things. So we think this will help with what a lot of code looks like. In particular, as I mentioned before, like using out parameters, for instance, you can't use that with async. But this, because tuple types are a type, you can certainly pass that type as an argument to task and get that back from an async. So you can get a task of tuple back. You await that method there, and you get a tuple back, and then you can decompose the tuple and get what you want. So we think, does that resonate with you as something that would, yeah? Good. Any boos anywhere? I want to catch both sides of this. Okay, good. Great. So that's one thing we're considering. Another thing that is really big in functional languages is this notion of pattern matching. Okay. So coming back to the wire data thing, having dumb data or hierarchies of data that's semi-structured, there might be, a person that can be student or professor and whatever, you kind of want to traverse and do different things depending on what it is. Well, the way we're used to doing shape-specific things to objects in object-oriented languages is we put a virtual method on the root type, on the base type, and then we override that for each shape and say, okay, for a student, I have to write out the GPA, and for a professor, I have to write out the salary or something, okay? But you can't, if you separate the description of the data from the functionality, if that's what you want to do, which it often is in distributed systems, you can't put a virtual method on it because you didn't write it. But you still want to dispatch on what shape it has. And so we want to introduce this notion of patterns, and I'll show you some ways that it can be used. The simplest form here is I have an object. I don't know if it's a point or not. So I can use the is operator to check if it's a point. But why don't we enhance the is operator a little and let you declare a variable while you're at it? Declare the variable p up there and say, okay, if it was a point, then p is now that point, and I can talk to it in a strongly typed way. So inside of the body of the if here, I now know that it's a point. I can say p.x and p.y, right? Because I just checked. So the point p there is a really simple pattern. It's a thing that a checks if something has a certain shape, and b, if it does, creates one or more variables that holds the results of that successful match. Does that make sense? And you can imagine having more kinds of patterns. We'll get down the list here a little bit. Of course, you can combine it now with other conditions that also know about the p and know that it's a point, because you just checked and it was a point. If I got here, it was a point, so I can dot into it. You can imagine having recursive patterns. And now it gets a little more crazy maybe, and we don't know where to draw the line yet, but we want to explore it and see And we can always go step by step over multiple versions of the language if it's a little too dangerous. But you could do something where you say, I want to take the x and the y and put into different variables and then use the x and the y later down the line there. Or maybe there's a way that point can say, the first thing is always x and the second thing is always y, and you can do it more positional, more like a tuple, if you will, or parameter list. Or maybe you can have constant patterns in there where you say it's point of... This matches if it's a point where the first thing is 5 and call the second thing y and let me use that in subsequent code. Okay. Yeah? So the downside here is it's quite new. It's quite different. We want to try to make it feel as much as C# as possible, but it also has to be efficient and terse and so on. So it's a little scary. It'll take some getting used to, but it's really, really good because it helps you declaratively describe your logic to get down the right branches. And it's much easier to look at that and see what exactly is the case I'm in here. You don't have like nested ifs and stuff, and you don't need temporary variables that you declare up front to hold things in if they were the right shape and so on. It sort of all comes together. The checking of what it is is declarative, that you introduce variables right in the spot where you check, so it's matched up evenly. It sort of fits with the shape of the data, if you will. So we like that. And that's something we've totally stolen from functional languages like F#, because we like that. And a more fancy way of using points would be to generalize the switch statement so that instead of just comparing it to constants, to constant expressions, what if each case could specify a pattern and saying this is the description of when I want to fall into this case? So that's pattern matching at the next level where you're taking one value and taking it through different possible shapes it can have and doing whatever corresponds to that shape. I get something in. If it was an int, I know it's an int. If it was a string, I know it's a string. If it's a point, I can pull it apart and use the x and the y of the point and so on. Think about, I don't have that on the slide, think about the student example again. You have a person, you don't know what they are, you'll write a switch to describe the functionality for when they're a student, when they're a professor, when they're something else. And the default for when they're neither, or when you don't know. So hopefully the pattern matching in these sort of integrated well into these existing features like is and switch should really help. We're also talking about an expression-based version of the switch here that is an expression that gives you where the cases, instead of being multiple statements, they're just expressions that you get back the value of when you do the match. But I took that slide out. Another thing we were thinking about is, there's all this, we're talking a lot about this data. It's actually, if you want an immutable class with value semantics, maybe, where you compare, when you do equals, you compare the values, not the references, and, you know, write hash code for that, and maybe, you know, implement iEquitable and blah, blah, blah. It's a lot of code. What if there was a shorthand for that scenario? If a lot of data is like that, maybe there should be a shorthand for specifying it. So maybe we could just write something like that, where you just say, class person is something with a string first and a string last, semicolon. And what you're saying there is it's really a record of that has all these properties and methods on it, implemented for you by the compiler. And if you don't like those default implementations or you want to add more things to it, well, you can still put a curly body on it, but it starts in a different place. It starts with much more readily generated for you. Maybe that's a good way of letting you describe just dumb data much more concisely. Okay? Again, object-oriented programming really sort of, especially in the traditional Java, C#, C++ way, it really heavily favors mutable objects with reference equality and so on. And you have to go around that and do stuff to get over that all the time. Maybe we can balance things more and make the playing field more even between an immutable data-focused approach and a mutable object-oriented approach. We want both to be good in the language. We want to be relevant to those new scenarios. Okay? So another thing would be if you have immutable objects, well, another thing you can't do then today is to use object initializers, because what they do is to assign into the object, and they can only assign into it if it's mutable, if it can be changed. So we want to somehow make that work for immutable objects. okay? By making it mean something else in those cases, and calling the constructor or whatever. We also would like to, a common thing you do, so if I have a, an immutable object describing some data, and I actually want to change it a little bit. Well, I can't because it's immutable, so the trick you do there is you create a new one that's similar to the old one with a few things changed. Well, that's cumbersome if I have to copy everything over. Maybe I don't know, maybe I'm looking at a person, but it might be a student in real time. I don't even know that it's extra stuff I need to copy over. So wouldn't it be nice if the language supported doing that, creating one just like it, except with some things changed. In this case, I made a point that's just like P1, except with X changed to the negative value of what was before, or to the negated from what it was before. So if you think about more and more properties, this is going to be increasingly useful. It has 10, I just want to change 2. That's a nice syntax for creating one that's similar to the other one except for those two. How we implement that under the hood? Well, we're still thinking about that. But we will try to come up with API patterns that you can implement yourself on your existing types, maybe even, maybe with extension methods so you don't touch, you want that other guy's immutable types, you want to put extension methods on it to allow this feature to happen. That would be the ideal. Okay. Excuse me. So we're almost down the line here. I'm going to skip this one. This is to the question from down here from before, nullability. We want to think about, so some languages have really strong management of null. Like if something can be null, you can't dot into it. And if you can dot into it, it can't be null. Okay, those two mutually exclusive. And they simply have two versions of a type, if you will, that look distinct. Sometimes it's one wraps the other, like option of T. Sometimes it's just two that coexist. But either way, it's sort of built into the language from scratch that things can't be null unless you let them from the beginning. And if you do, you've lost the ability to dot in without checking first, with special features in the language that unpack the value underneath and stuff like that. And we don't want to do something rigid like that, and we can't. We are in version 7 here, right? So if we are to help you not have null reference exceptions, we have to do something that's lighter but still useful. So here's what we're thinking currently, and it's a little, it's interesting, but we'll keep noodling on it until we have something that we feel doesn't come across as a breaking change to the language. We want to let you specify your intent. So maybe in the future, you can put a question mark on a type to say, I intend for this to be nullable. And what that does is that if somebody then takes the, if somebody takes the n and assigns null into it, fine. But if they take something that didn't intend to be nullable, then maybe you get a warning saying, ah, did you mean that? And of course, you can't then assign something that could be nullable into something that can't without getting a warning. We're thinking warnings, not errors here, because that would be less breaking. And we're thinking about maybe some of this is, it certainly needs to be optional. Maybe it's even one of those analyzers that I talked about before. Maybe it's not part of the core language to specify the rules that give you the warnings. Maybe the only thing that's in the language is the syntax to specify it. But anyway, this would prevent you from putting null in there unless you intended it to, and it would tell you if you forget to initialize a field that starts out as null and isn't supposed to be when the object is finished. Then on the other side, on the flip side of the assigning null to it, we would do checks when you dot into it saying, is it nullable or not? Well, if this could be null, then you probably shouldn't dot. We'll give you a warning. However, if you check first, not with some new fancy feature, but if you check in the ways that you're used to checking for null, and we see you doing that, then we'll say, all right, we know it's probably not null because you just checked. Unless you were sneaky and had a different thread that assigned it, right? Well, we're probably going to be lenient and say, we take your word for it here. It looks like you were checked for null, so we're going to let you dot. Okay, so your existing code, even if you annotate with these things, should continue to work without warnings mostly because you checked for null. And if you didn't, well, you'd probably like to know about it, and that's what this feature is really about, right? It's like telling you when you do something that's probably dangerous. You might also know better than the compiler, in which case we have the bang there. We call it the damn it operator right now because it says, hey, I know that n is not null here. I checked in other ways. You just can't see it, compiler, but I'm telling you right here. Okay. So something like that. So that's the kind of thinking, a soft thing that lets you express your intent and gives you warnings and can be turned off. That's the best we can do without breaking the language, but maybe it's quite good. So we're going to want to prototype this, share it out early, long before the language actually gets set in stone. Have you guys possibly apply it to your real-world code and see, was that crazy or was it actually pretty good? And tell us. really hope to be able to do that, because we're really in doubt here. Is this too much jiggering, too much breaking changiness, or can we do this somehow? We want to do it. Hopefully we can. Smaller things I'm going to skip mostly. Yeah, ref returns and locals help return a reference to a struct, and slices help get a view onto an array, and local functions declare a function within another function so it can capture things that are already in scope, like building an iterator inside of here. Those are all the things we're considering. I don't have more time because I'm getting like a big wave from them. That's impressive. So that's what we have to share right now. If you're interested, go to GitHub, look at our design note, participate in the discussion, tell us when we're crazy and when we're not, or which ways we're crazy. And thanks for listening. Thank you.